Beer, Cheese, and Murder is a true crime podcast about Wisconsin from Wisconsin. Due to the nature of true crime, this podcast contains explicit and graphic content which may not be suitable for all listeners. Listener discretion is advised. Welcome to Beer, Cheese, and Murder. I'm Erica, and joining me today are
Bonnie,
Dina,
Jill,
and Terry.
All right. So, Bonnie, what are you drinking? Mom.
I'm drinking Bloody Mary, which is made with Pop's Bloody Mary mix, handcrafted from Wisconsin, with love. And this is right at right from Pops, and it's an estimated 2021.
So where is Pops?
Pops is right in Muskego.
Oh really? Oh, is it like the same as
the popcorn? Yeah, the popcorn.
Yeah.
They make Bloody Mary mix.
Yeah.
Was that from the Bossy's Market? Is that where you got it from, Bonnie?
Well, actually, I got it. We had Christmas in July with our legal department, and it was White Elephant gift exchange.
Hmm.
So someone else from the legal department that lives in Muskego, and that's where they got it from.
Awesome.
Well, that's interesting. A pretty nice white elephant gift.
Yeah.
When like, I had to, perfect. I can use this.
Right. When I had to give a white elephant gift, I gave a year old Milwaukee firefighter calendar.
Well, the rule of the
entire year. Like the Kilty Pleasures calendar.
When you're like, well, what day was it today a year ago?
Let me get that. The person who got it didn't realize it was the year old, so I think he hung it up and he was using it for a little bit
until he realized everything was a day off.
You're like, I'm off by a day. How does this keep happening?
You know, I'm like, dude, it's a year old. That's why it was a white elephant.
Well, the rule for this one was that the gift had to be something red or green. So the red is the Bloody Mary mix, and then the green is the Wisco Kitchen Spicy Dilly Beans.
Hmm, that's awesome. Ooh. What a cool thing.
Let's see, where is this?
Dilly
Beans. And this was also bought at Pops, but they are, the Wisco Kitchen is 302 State Beloit, Wisconsin.
Oh, Beloit, okay.
Yeah.
Hmm. Can I interject real quick and not even on this topic, but that just made me think about food when she had the little dilly.
Yeah.
When we were discussing the Usinger, the way how it's pronounced. Mm-hmm. Today, when I was with my dad, we were in the car after we left the Brewers game. And they had the Bob Uecker commercial on the radio where he says it, and he's the spokesperson, and he says Usinger.
Ooh, the hard G, not the hard JG.
G. Right.
Usinger. Okay, yeah.
Usinger. I think that's so how like, I've always like said I say it, but the G was hard, which I was not saying.
Huh. Thank you for that follow-up.
Now we know, according to Bob Uecker. And I he's getting paid by Usinger, so.
Usinger.
I guarantee I will say it wrong, like, every time.
I thought of it. I'm like, I got to remember to bring it up tonight. So
there you
that's
go.
My 2 cents from Bob Uecker.
All right. Well, Jill, what are you snacking on?
All right. So I'm just drinking water, but I did a wine and chocolate tasting last week in Elm Grove. And I don't usually get over there too much, but apparently there's a craft chocolatier there, and it's called Fazio's. And I texted a picture to Erica that I'm sure she'll be posting, but it says, sweet moments, sweet life, artisan chocolates. And apparently they also have gelato and sorbetto. Ooh. So I wasn't actually at the store because the tasting was at, I don't know how they say it, if it's Yemas family restaurant or Yemas, it's Y-E-M-A-S. So we were actually at that restaurant. So the address is 13425 Watertown Plank Road, Suite 7, Elm Grove, Wisconsin. Fazio's, that's F as in Frank, A, Z as in Zebra, I, O, S, chocolate.com. And they are delicious. What I tried with the pairings, the wines were not Wisconsin region. I did buy some wine, but just for tonight, I'm going to be treating myself to some of these chocolates. One is an amaretto, what is it? Amaretto crunch or something? Amaretto infused ganache. And it says dipped in milk chocolate and topped with a slivered almond. The other one, which I'm going to have to say was my favorite, was the key lime. Oh my gosh.
Key lime chocolate. Interesting.
Oh yeah. Key lime ganache in a white chocolate shell finished with a graham cracker crust.
Ooh, nice.
That was the bomb, or it is the bomb, because I bought a 4-pack of those. And I couldn't display that one because I had already eaten one of those. But and then a berry ganache, which was a cookie berry crunch. And it says berry ganache with a chocolate cookie in a dark chocolate shell. And the classic one was a pecan snappy turtle, caramel and roasted pecans enrobed in milk chocolate and dusted with sea salt. And they're all amazing.
Sounds good. Fazio's. Well, that's not too far away. I feel like I definitely need to make a trip to go to some of these places. Like Pops is in Muskego, so that can't be too far.
Yeah, that's really close.
Oh man. Okay. So got some exploring to do in my own backyard, it sounds like.
Be a tourist in your own town. Gotta love
it. Like, I feel like it's those types of places that are like right there that you never go to, but been to more places outside of my own city.
Exactly. Yeah.
All right. Well, I am drinking sticking with the beer and cheese this episode. So I am drinking a Sticky McDougal.
So for people that are listening, Erica takes her picture that she posts on Instagram and sends it to all of us right before the podcast starts. So we have an idea of what she's eating and drinking to maybe give us a hint or whatever. But the way that the writing is on the can, I said she's drinking a Sucky McDougal. And then I looked closer and I'm like, oh, it's Sticky. I guess it makes sense that it wouldn't call a beer Sucky. It looks like Sucky. Yeah, never not know. Sticky.
I don't know. I drink a batshit crazy, so you never know what they might call it. But yeah, so this is a Sticky McDougal, which is a Scotch ale, appropriately. And this is from Ale Asylum out of Madison, Wisconsin. And this is, it's about a 7.4 ABV. And
I was just told that the Ale Asylum is closing in Madison.
No.
Yeah, I was just told that.
A lot of stuff from there. Well, yeah. I'm glad I'm trying it before they close.
Yeah, I was surprised by that.
That's too bad.
Yeah.
So it's a Scotch ale and a 7.4% ABV. And so they call it a wee heavy. So
a wee bit heavy.
A wee
bit sticky.
And then it said this traditional Scotch ale is full bodied with an earthy aroma. It has a smooth malt presence with just the right touch of hops for balanced, clean finish. And then I already ate my snack, as it is difficult to eat while I do this podcast. But I had an apple smoked cheddar cheese from Red. Good. Yeah, it is good. From Red Apple Cheese, which is in Barron, Wisconsin, and it's a naturally smoked with apple and hardwood. And it had describes it as a sweet, smoky, yet cream sharp cheddar. Or creamy sharp cheddar, pair with Merlot or brown or amber ale. So it does work out well with the sticky McDougal, which was just happenstance as it was.
I like how they actually tell you on there what to pair it with. Like, yeah. That's very helpful.
Yeah. Agreed. I'm just going to do whatever I want either way, but it's good to know.
It's nice.
Right. But then at least, you know, oh.
Yeah. No. I actually used the first I used the cheese was I made some on the fly. I made some like scalloped red potatoes, and I after I like sauteed it all up, I just kind of shredded some of the smoked apple cheddar cheese over the top. Good. So good.
I don't love smoked stuff, but the apple smoked sounds good to me because it'll have a little bit of sweetness to it.
Yeah, and I think the only thing that would have made it better is if I had added some of like the apple hard or like apple smoked bacon to it. That would have just like really been the bomb. But anyway,
over the top.
Next breakfast. All right, so that is what we are eating and drinking. So I am gonna jump into it. So surprise, I'm actually going to forego a specific fact. Because this episode is going to be riddled with them. So buckle up and enjoy.
Riddled with facts?
Yes. So you'll kind of understand. So I feel like I've just been so crazy busy with stuff this week so far, honestly, has been stressful. So I just needed something a little bit more fun, but also light. So I don't know. I took it in a different direction. So this episode is about Wisconsin's gangster history.
Gangster
history.
Gangster paradise.
Yes. So I'm just going to talk about Wisconsin and our tie to various gangsters, some that are pretty infamous and famous, and just share some facts with everybody about how Wisconsin... I don't know, came to tie in and some of the things that you can experience today to reminisce about the history. So here we go. All right. So the Prohibition and the Great Depression of the 1920s and 30s were lucrative times for outlaws like Al Capone and John Dillinger. Charismatic and successful, they were polarizing figures, unpopular with the FBI and local police. The usual suspects were often on the run, and that usually meant Wisconsin. Wooded and rural, Wisconsin was popular among Chicago-based gangsters for its isolation. Our Wisconsin hideouts also made great places to stash the booze they were smuggling on the way to Canada. The state played host to a number of infamous figures, including Capone and Dillinger. So there is multiple gangsters, but those are probably the two most infamous ones that are tied to Wisconsin in particular. So Al Capone, as we mostly know him, was actually born Alphonse Gabriel Capone in January of 1899. He was sometimes known by the nickname Scarface, and he was an American gangster and businessman who attained notoriety during the Prohibition era as the co-founder and boss of the Chicago Outfit. So his seven-year reign as a crime boss ended when he went to prison at the age of 33. So
I never knew that he was Scarface.
Yeah.
Never put that together. Never knew that.
Like, yeah. As in Scarface the movie?
Yeah, I guess Al Pacino really doesn't look like Al Capone. Both Al's, I guess.
But both Al.
Yep. But it's kind of crazy to think, especially being like myself at 34, that he was 33 when he went to prison.
And he'd been the crime boss for seven years.
Right. That's so young.
Get your shit together. You're way behind on becoming a crime boss.
I guess so. Man, I really got to step up my game.
Step it up.
So Capone was born in New York City in 1899 to Italian immigrant parents. So a lot of this information comes from Wikipedia, at least. So it's a mix of various websites, which I will share the links to, but a lot of this information on Al Capone, and I will also talk about John Dillinger, come from Wikipedia. So Capone was born in New York City in 1899 to Italian immigrant parents. He joined the Five Points gang as a teenager and became a bouncer in organized crime premises, such as brothels. Fun place to be. In his early 20s, he moved to Chicago and became a bodyguard and trusted factotum. Interesting. For Johnny Torrio, head of the criminal syndicate that illegally supplied alcohol, the forerunner of the outfit. So he first kind of stepped into, he kind of worked his way up into his position as the crime boss by first starting out as a bodyguard. So he was politically protected through Union Siciliana. So that sounds interesting. I mean, you got to talk
still like,
yeah, during the Great Depression time period and Prohibition. Torrio went into retirement after the North Side gunman almost killed him and handed the control of his gang over to Capone. So he must have, you know, really been in his good graces enough with him that he was kind of the heir apparent to take over the gang. Once he was in leadership, Capone expanded the bootlegging business through increasingly violent means, but his mutually profitable relationships with Mayor William Hale Thompson and the city's police meant he seemed safe from law enforcement. Gotta love the corruption.
Right.
And there's a lot of it. Interesting how 100 years hasn't changed much, right?
Right.
Okay. Capone apparently reveled in attention, such as the cheers from spectators when he appeared at ball games. He made donations to various charities and was viewed by many as a modern day Robin Hood.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
Huh. Wouldn't have expected that.
Yeah, well, however, the St. Valentine's Day Massacre, in which seven rival gang members were murdered in broad daylight, damaged the public image of Chicago and Capone, leading influential citizens to demand government action and newspapers to dub Capone public enemy number one. So, kind of ruined the whole Robin Hood reputation he had going.
Robin Hood to public enemy number one. That didn't take very long. Yeah,
quite polar opposite.
Yeah, indeed. The federal authorities became intent on jailing Capone and charged him with 22 counts of tax evasion. He was convicted of 5 counts in 1931. During a highly publicized case, the judge admitted as evidence Capone's admissions of his income and unpaid taxes made during prior and ultimately abortive negotiations to pay the government taxes he owed. He was convicted and sentenced to 11 years in federal prison. So, I mean, clearly not the worst crimes he ever committed, but all they could really get him on. After conviction, he replaced his defense team with experts in tax law, and his grounds for appeal were strengthened by a Supreme Court ruling, but his appeal ultimately failed. Capone showed signs of neurosyphilis early in his sentence and became increasingly debilitated before being released after almost 8 years of incarceration. But
syphilis damage of the neurological system? What's neurosyphilis?
Neurosyphilis, I think it was, I think he had contracted syphilis and it was
in his nerves.
It was the it neural impacts system? The mind. If it's not, not treated. And on, so I mean, he did spend 8 years in jail and he was released, but I think the damage from his medical condition was like he couldn't come back from it. So on January 25th, 1947, he died of cardiac arrest after a stroke. I mean, he was only like
48. Yeah. Wow. Who knew? I did not know.
Didn't he have like a house or a cabin in Wisconsin? I thought
he did. And so did his brother. So we'll talk about it actually next.
Just like everybody else in Chicago.
Yeah. Right. From Illinois. Hey, well, fun fact, I'm pretty sure, at least I believe this is true. I'd have to look it up, but I believe Oprah had a cabin on Round Lake in Hayward at one point in time. I don't think she does anymore, but so even Oprah had a cabin in Wisconsin.
She's from Chicago, so it makes sense.
No, I thought she was actually from Milwaukee.
She actually is from Wisconsin.
Moved
to Chicago to do the news.
Good catch.
Wow. Yes. Clearly, I'm not up on my Oprah information.
You're excused just this once.
You're up on your killers.
All right. So Al Capone himself was known to enjoy a refuge in the North Woods of Wisconsin. For a time, he owned a summer home on Cranberry Lake near Hayward. So Hayward, Wisconsin as well. And legend says it was fortified with a machine gun turret, and that Capone used hydroplanes to smuggle whiskey from Canada.
Hydroplane. Oh, water aircraft. Gotcha.
Yeah, water plane. Yeah. The Capone brothers, mostly Al and Ralph, so Al Capone and his brother Ralph, had a passion for the outdoors and hunting. Ralph had been to Wisconsin many times before for hunting trips. In the early 1940s, he left Chicago behind and became a permanent Wisconsin resident. So for a period of time, Al Capone is probably the one that everyone knows the best, but Ralph was kind of right along there with him. So at one point in time, Al Capone, while he was public enemy number one, Ralph was actually public enemy number three.
Who was two?
I don't know.
Of course, I'll have to
look
ask,
it up,
right?
But it's kind of odd that they would be one and then three. So, but Ralph himself, so while Al Capone did have a summer cabin or a summer home up here, Ralph actually liked Wisconsin so much that he became a permanent resident in the 1940s. He bought property and built a lodge in Mercer called Billy's Bar, which also had a hotel and slot machines. And they used this location, they used this property as a place where the Capone family could reunite in private. So it was like a place of family gatherings. But as most things in common with his brother Al, Ralph made sure never to personally own anything on paper that the government could take away. Sure. So the lodge in Mercer was one of those properties. So he owned it, but on paper, it didn't show him as owning it. So when Vincenzo James Capone, aka Richard Two Gun Hart, came back officially into the Capone family fold after living his life as a fearless lawman, he was sent to testify at the Kefauver hearings in 1950. And during his testimony, he was stated as saying the Wisconsin properties had belonged to him. So it sounds like he had been on the other side of the law from his brothers for a period of time, but came back into the family fold. And I think part of his being welcomed back into the family was taking claim of ownership over this property in Wisconsin or the Wisconsin properties. So that his brothers couldn't be tied to him. With little meager earning as a lawman in government, the interrogators wondered how he could afford the property. The convenient answer was that the matriarch Teresa, who had squirreled away a life savings enough to purchase the property, the matriarch had purchased the property and had the lodge built and essentially gifted it to him. So that's kind of the story that they came up with, and they were sticking to it. at least initially. So, and that was enough to satisfy or placate the government officials who were probably corrupt. In later years, when Ralph Capone was again interrogated by tax investigators, so they really wanted to get these guys on tax evasion, still wanting back taxes owed to the government, Ralph claimed that the properties belonged to his sister Mafalda. So during this trial, the brother claimed that they were his, and then years later during interrogation, he claimed that it was his sisters that owed him, so, or owned them. So they couldn't quite keep their story straight, but I think it was hard to pin down. Eventually he did actually sell the property, but he did continue to live in Wisconsin. And so he lived up north for decades, and he died in 1974 in Hurley, Wisconsin. So
74, really?
Yeah. Yep. So they were pretty tied to Wisconsin, that's for sure. So I also mentioned John Dillinger as having ties to Wisconsin. So John Herbert Dillinger was born June 22nd in 1903, and he was also an American gangster during the Great Depression. Yeah, he led the Dillinger gang, which was accused of robbing 24 banks and 4 police stations. Now that's ballsy.
Robbed 4 police stations.
You're going to go big.
That is some cocky shit right there.
Yeah.
Dillinger was in prison several times and escaped twice, as a lot of the people we talk about on this podcast apparently do. He was charged but not convicted of the murder of an East Chicago, Indiana police officer who shot Dillinger in his bulletproof vest during a shootout. It was the only time Dillinger was actually charged with homicide. So wow. It's interesting that he wasn't convicted. Dillinger, like Al Capone, publicly courted publicity, and the media ran exaggerated accounts of his bravado and colorful personality and cast him as a Robin Hood. So I found that very interesting that both Al Capone and John Dillinger were both kind of viewed as Robin Hood like characters.
Well, and did you say that the media kind of glammed on?
Yeah, it was more that they really loved the attention. Both of them really fed on the attention. And so I think they promoted that positive image. And so it kind of reminds me of Ted Bundy. I bring him up a lot, but he really loved the attention, and he was joking around with the media, and they really thought he was charming. You know what I mean? Yeah. And to me, it's same kind of idea, in that these are bad guys. They're gangsters. They're robbing banks. They're, killing bunches of people. They're, bootlegging booze. But they have this charming personality. So in response, J. Edgar Hoover, director of the Bureau of Investigation. So before the FBI, it was the Bureau of Investigation, just BOI, which is not nearly as exciting. So he used...
Yeah, boy.
It actually put it in there as BOI, and I'm like, what is B-O-I? And I'm like, oh, Bureau. And I'm like, that's...
Bureau of Investigation.
Yeah, or BI. At least it's not BO, right?
Well, we don't say FBOI, Federal Bureau of Investigation.
Yeah, right.
And that was before they were we're not going to do words like of or the as part of the acronym. So J. Edgar Hoover used Dillinger as a campaign platform to evolve the Bureau of Investigation into the Federal Bureau of Investigation. So he was actually part of the motivation to take it from the BOI to FBI, because that allowed them to develop more sophisticated investigative techniques as weapons against organized crime. So I think it was more of a widespread organization, gave them a little bit more power from a law enforcement body, if you will. So I thought that was kind of cool. It's kind of like really integral and key to like the foundation of what we know as the FBI. After evading police in four states for almost a year, Dillinger was wounded and went to his father's home to recover. He returned to Chicago in July 1934 and sought refuge in a brothel. Again, I don't know why these brothels are a part of the story. Owned by Anna Campanas, who later informed authorities of his whereabouts. So clearly you can't trust people in a brothel. On July 22nd of 1934, local and federal law enforcement officers closed in on the Biograph Theater. And when the BOI agents moved to arrest Dillinger as he exited the theater and tried to flee, he was fatally shot in the back.
And where was this? What state?
This was in, I think it was in Chicago.
Okay.
And the deadly shot was ruled as justifiable homicide. So
I agree.
All right. So gangster crimes in Wisconsin. So those are some infamous characters that are tied to Wisconsin. And we'll talk a little bit more about some of the specific ties. The Capones are more, I think, famous for some of the locations and that they owned. And I think there's even some haunted history tied to those. I won't get into the haunted side of it, though, at least for this episode. But if anybody is interested in looking it up, I think you can find some information on that. One specific crime associated with Wisconsin, we have Chicago Blackie and his gang terrorized Schulzburg. So this is another gangster also from Chicago, them darn Illinois people.
Eat those fibs down in Illinois, they belong.
We don't need your gangsters.
Gangster asses.
In the summer of 1925, an armed gang held Schulzburg, a small southwestern Wisconsin mining town, captive. Criminals led by Chicago Blackie, an alias for bank robber Joe Dossie, had cut all the phone lines leading to town. The Dubuque Telegraph Herald reported that men wielding sawed-off shotguns terrorized the townspeople for more than 2 hours with volleys of buckshot before blasting the vault of the First National Bank with explosives.
Dang.
Wow.
Yeah. Sacks of non-negotiable bank bonds were dumped in northern Illinois on a road leading back to Chicago, which is just a complete waste.
So they robbed it and then they dumped them?
It sounds like it. I don't know if they did it intentionally, but they definitely lost it during their escape.
Yeah, because you said non-negotiable.
Yeah, like what the heck?
Oh, well, yeah.
What did they steal?
Well, it looks like they broke into the bank vault, so they probably grabbed everything that was in there. What they ended up dumping were non-negotiable bank bonds.
Okay, so maybe what they couldn't actually spend, they
kept dumped, the cash,
but they got away with the rest.
Yeah.
The jury acquitted Dossie, but he went to jail for other robberies and boasted that he had blown more than 200 bank safes. The bank failed during the Great Depression, but the vault is part of a restaurant today called the Water Street Place Pub and Eatery. A bullet-ridden sign from that day is at the local mining museum.
At what town?
This is Schulzburg. It's a southwestern Wisconsin. Yeah, I've
never heard of that.
Yeah. So apparently we need to take a road trip and have some lunch at the Water Street Place Pub and Eatery.
Right? Sounds kind of cool, actually, to
see. Yeah, well, they've got a mining museum. That's, I mean, maybe I'm a dork, but I think that sounds cool, too.
Well, dork,
but. Such a dork.
I know. I like history as much as I made fun of my dad for always watching the History Channel when I was a kid. I can't help but be sucked into these kinds of things. All right. So another one was the Jefferson Bank robbed by the Valentine's Day Massacre assassin. So there's a lot of bank robbery going on by these gangsters. That's for sure. Clearly, that is how they kept themselves funded.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. In November 1929, about 9 months after the notorious St. Valentine's Day massacre in Chicago, Fred Killer Burke, one of Al Capone's triggermen, showed up in Jefferson to rob the Farmers and Merchants Bank. His crew fired shots into the bank furniture after the head cashier tried to set off the alarm. They got off with nearly $400,000 in cash and bonds, and only 10,000 of it was covered by insurance.
Ooh. Oh my God. Wow.
For the bank? Oh my gosh.
Before the FDIC?
Yeah. Oh my gosh.
Damn.
Months later, after Burke was captured in Michigan, the bank's president got a call offering to return most of the cash if the bank wouldn't press charges.
Already cutting his deals.
Yeah, right? But two, to think that months later, they still had most of the cash.
Right.
$400,000 was a lot of money to spend in a short period of time.
Yeah, that's true. Especially
back in the day.
According to the son of bank president Lynn Smith, Smith met the gangsters several times in abandoned schoolhouses and got the bank's money back.
Wow, impressive.
Now that's a story right there. That's a family story right there. And we also talked a bit about John Dillinger, and he is famous for Little Bohemia. So John Dillinger robbed a bank in Racine in 1933, but spent even more time within the Wisconsin. In April of 1934, Dillinger needed a place to recover from bullet wounds from an FBI shootout in the Twin Cities. He, Babyface Nelson, and their gang found refuge at Little Bohemia Lodge, just outside of Manitowish Waters.
All of these nicknames are just killing me.
Yeah, unlike ours, what was that, Farthead Cheeseburger or something? Fucker Burger. Like, stupid names.
I mean, like, I'm a badass. What's my nickname going to be? Babyface.
Like, our face,
okay. Babyface. All right, there, tough guy.
Killer.
All right,
it's a little to the point. It's a little too on the nose right there. The FBI closed in, but agents shot innocent customers by mistake. Ooh, ouch. Giving Dillinger and Nelson a chance to flee and giving tourists a reason to stop and see bullet holes ever since. Local lore says Dillinger buried a suitcase stuffed with $200,000 in woods nearby. So it's a legend. So either somebody found it and never said anything, or it hasn't been found.
If I found it, I wouldn't say anything.
Right. You can also visit Dillman's Bay Resort in Lac du Flambeau, where Nelson, so Babyface Nelson, hid out from the FBI after the fact of the Little Bohemia shootout. So, and I think the reason why John Dillinger and that whole situation is so well known is because of Public Enemies movie with Johnny Depp.
Yeah. Mm.
And I mean, based on the description, I haven't seen it either, but there's a tie in here too, because they actually filmed it in Wisconsin. But after the description of John Dillinger, with him being like courting publicity and just being like a real character and charming and, you know, modern day Robin Hood of the time, I guess, I can definitely see why they cast Johnny Depp as, not to mention, he does actually kind of resemble John Dillinger.
He's nice to look at, so that's all right.
another item tied to crime with gangsters in Wisconsin is there were Elkhart Lake gambling dens. So during the Roaring Twenties, the town was a gambling mecca with at least four casinos. The train would bring mobsters to town to gamble. An undercover reporter from Milwaukee wrote, "Never have games of chance been operated more openly or with less regard for anti-gambling laws. This ended when the revenuers showed up, busting up slot machines and shutting down the gambling halls. Today, an upscale restaurant, the Paddock Club, pays homage to Elkhart Lake's most notorious gambling joint. So, used to be like they'd just ship them in by the trainload of mobsters and just gambling around in Elkhart Lake. All right. So then there are a number of places, some of which we've already talked about, that have ties to gangsters in Wisconsin. So I'm just kind of going to go through them. So we already talked a little bit about Little Bohemia Lodge in Manitowish Waters. So we talked about the 1934 firefight between Dillinger Gang and the FBI. And that lodge still operates as a restaurant and was used as an authentic location for the Public Enemy's recreation of that fateful night. So they actually did shoot scenes for that movie at that location, which was where it actually occurred, which is kind of cool. The property has been faithfully preserved to maintain its unique history. Original bullet holes still pepper the walls. Dillinger memorabilia is on display, and legends of a missing bag lost in the shuffle of the gang's escape remain. So I'm assuming that's the $200,000 suitcase. So maybe, just maybe, if you go searching in the woods, you might be able to find it.
Show me the money.
That's exactly what I was just going to say. That's,
I can't imagine.
Crazy.
We never think alike, Dina. I don't know.
Seriously. Everybody says we sound alike, and now we think alike.
Also tied to that shootout is Doman's Bay Resort in Lac du Flambeau. Cabin 5 was used by Babyface Nelson as a hideout following his escape from the FBI shootout at the Little Bohemia Lodge. So specifically, cabin number 5, which is probably the one that's always booked, is the one that has some pretty strong gangster ties. Then there's the Norwood Pine Supper Club in Minocqua. It was a popular gangster dinner spot. Norwood Pines still operates as a restaurant surrounded by stately red pines, views of Patricia Lake, and grazing white-tailed deer.
I wonder if I've been there, because Minocqua is not very big, and I've eaten at a lot of different restaurants up there.
Yeah, and we've been there for a couple of board meetings. I feel like we had to have been there at some point. Barker Lake Lodge and Golf Course in Hayward, Wisconsin. So Chicago gang leader and speakeasy operator Pollock Joe Seltis owned a 238-acre estate on Barker Lake near the town of Winter in Sawyer County, which was not far from Al Capone's estate, interestingly enough. Today, visitors can stay in the historic lodge and play golf at the Barker Lake Golf Course, a classic nine-hole layout that Seltis built in the 1920s. So, lasting impact of these gangsters, that's for sure. Also in Hayward, Wisconsin, we have Herman's Landing Resort. Does that sound familiar, Mom?
Yep, that's where we stay.
Yeah, now known as The Landing. According to Wise Guy legend, in 1949, Joey the Doves, Wappa.
The Dove.
The Doves.
That's very fierce.
Right. Right. The Doves, you're so scary.
Just wait till you get a whiff of this legend. It's kind of a ridiculous legend. Okay, so according to Wise Guy legend, Joey the Doves caught a world record muskie at Herman's Landing Resort. On the run from the law, he sold the 69-pound, 11-ounce fish to Lewis Spray.
Oh, my gosh.
Spray, a former bootlegger himself, registered the catch as his own and has been recognized as the world record holder ever since. So,
wow.
Talk about...
He was robbed! What's his face was robbed from the title.
Well, he gave it up because he was on the run.
I know. Mm-hmm. Get it? He was robbed.
Yeah.
While he was on the run, did he stop and go fishing now?
Like, apparently.
Apparently, that's what he did.
That's the thing, is when they were on the run, they just came to Wisconsin to hide out. But I think if they all came here, if you were any type of investigator worth your salt, you would be like, oh, well, they're in Wisconsin.
Yeah. they're we'll in just the woods go over to that one area where they all like to stay.
Right.
Get them all up at once.
Well, Al Capone's up in Hayward, and so is this one dude. So clearly that's where they are. So Hurley, Wisconsin, Hurley's Silver Street District was popular among vacationing gangsters and remains full of lively nightclubs. And it is also the location where Ralph Capone, Al Capone's brother, actually passed away.
Isn't Hurley where everybody goes to go snowmobiling?
There's a lot of places that right. people go for snowmobiling.
I think that Hurley is like where people that I know when they're going up on like a snowmobiling trip, I think everybody goes to Hurley. I think. If that's true, when this airs, people will text me and let me know.
Yeah, I don't snowmobile, so I can't really help you there. In Mercer, Wisconsin. So as previously mentioned, that was where Ralph Capone originally made his home when he became a Wisconsin resident. Today, Mercer is known for its secluded waterways and outdoor activities such as boating, fishing, biking, hiking, and swimming. I feel like secluded waterways seems like something that gangsters would have taken advantage of back in the day.
Yeah.
Milwaukee. You know, for all of this talk about gangsters, there's really not a whole lot of mention of Milwaukee, which I personally find surprising. There definitely seem to be a lot more interested in the seclusion of the North Woods. I will say that.
They would be spotted easier in Milwaukee. So
yeah. It is bigger, but yeah, no, I suppose that's true. But yeah. So during the Mafia's heyday, Milwaukee was home to some of the organization's most powerful men, including Frank Balestrieri. Fun fact, I went to school with a girl last name Balestrieri. Don't know if they're related. Who was considered for head of the commission, which was the Mafia's governing body. So
is that's that part like, of the Balestrieri family that owns all of the Balestrieri restaurants?
Probably. So Racine Art Museum in Racine, Wisconsin. So formerly the bank or American Bank and Trust, the building housed a bank that was robbed by John Dillinger and his gang in 1933. This is one of the many banks that John Dillinger robbed. And then again, following a brief shootout and hostage situation, Dillinger's crew made off with $27,000. The museum has previously housed exhibits commemorating the robbery, including a submachine gun that is now displayed at the Racine Police Department.
And that was in the 1930s?
1933.
Yeah, so 27 grand was a pretty lot. Good chunk of change.
Yep. I hope it was insured.
Right.
So Water's Edge of Lake Geneva in Lake Geneva. The Water's Edge was frequented by a number of gangsters in the 1920s and 30s, most notably by Bugs Moran.
Bugs.
Bugs reputedly
good stayed. Bugs.
Yeah. Did he have buck teeth, maybe?
No, Bugs. Bugs. That old? Bugs, as in like B-U-G-S, not Bugs.
Yeah.
And yeah, Bugs Bunny. Bugs
Bunny.
Yeah, oh. That's what I was
saying.
Maybe he
liked
carrots. Maybe he liked carrots and he would be like, what's up, Doc?
He liked carrots.
I mean, I don't know. How old is Bugs Bunny? When did that come about?
Yeah.
Maybe Bugs Bunny is named after Bugs.
Bugs Moran. Could be. Could be.
Maybe he had a bug collection. Who knows?
I'm going to have to look it up now. Bugs reputedly stayed frequently to avoid the police with the now B&B doubling as the speakeasy. So the Water's Edge is now bed and breakfast.
Blah. Breakfast? Terry, have you done that? What
breakfast. Was that? 9%? 9% ABV?
Yeah, not that much. Oh my gosh. Okay. And I haven't even drinking like half of it. Okay.
No, I'm kidding.
Terry, have you been there? Because you go to Lake Geneva.
I want to say I have. I'd have to look it up and then I could tell you. If I did it, I didn't stay there. It probably was like for a drink or lunch or something.
Bug's wife, Lucille, would eventually divorce him and marry the establishment's original owner. So he apparently stayed there enough that his wife fell in love with the owner.
Ooh, I wonder if he woke up with a horse's head in his bed one day.
I don't know. Sounds like that was fairly amicable. So I'm sure he had plenty of side pieces.
Side pieces.
Be like, good riddance, taker. So then, as mentioned, there was a movie that was made about John Dillinger that starred Johnny Depp, and it was called Public Enemies, and it was actually filmed in Wisconsin. So it came out in 2009. It was set during the Great Depression. The film chronicles the final years of the notorious bank robber John Dillinger as he was pursued by FBI agent Melvin Purvis. So there are some locations that are tied to this movie within Wisconsin because of the filming, which is kind of cool. So the other thing to remember about John Dillinger was he was only like 30 or 31 years old. So they're talking like the final years, like he was young. He was born in 1903 and he died in 1934. So kind of these guys, they lived on, they had a death wish, that's for sure. All right, so some of the locations tied to this movie, we have Madison. So Public Enemies served as a homecoming for director Michael Mann, who attended the University of Wisconsin-Madison. So that's kind of cool. And the crew shot in a number of Madison locations, including in and around the Wisconsin State Capitol building, which they used as FBI headquarters in the film. Hmm. They also, for some of the street scenes, they utilized Madison residents as extras, with casting taking place at the Monona Terrace Community and Convention Center.
Nice.
And then they also utilized the nearby city of Oregon to host additional filming for the movie. Milwaukee County Historical Society building. So several of the scenes from the movie were filmed in Milwaukee, including a bank robbery scene at the Milwaukee County Historical Society building. And it said a fitting choice as the building was converted from a bank. So it used to be a bank back in the day. There's a Lafayette County Courthouse in Darlington, Wisconsin. Johnny Depp stood for trial for Public Enemies at the courthouse in handcuffs and leg shackles at the Lafayette County Courthouse, which substituted for the Lake County Courthouse in Crown Point, Indiana, where Dillinger was arraigned after being captured. So some of those locations represented places outside of Wisconsin, but they did pretty much do all the shooting in Wisconsin, which is pretty cool.
I used to date a guy from Darlington.
Was he a darling?
I was kind of a darling, in fact.
Downtown Columbus. So for Public Enemies, all of downtown Columbus, like the entire downtown, was converted into Greencastle, Indiana, circa 1933, which was the site of a $75,000 robbery by Dillinger and his gang, with the West James Gallery made into Central National Bank. So they actually converted an entire downtown area into like a city. So it's kind of cool. And it said that the city was selected because of its good bones, in that the entire downtown commercial area is on the National Historic Register.
Oh,
that was Darlington?
No, Columbus.
Columbus, Wisconsin?
Yeah, it's outside of Madison, like past some prairie.
Huh, okay.
So I guess for those of us that are history dorks, it might be a cool place to go check out if it's on the National Historic Register.
There's not much in Columbus, so yeah.
Main Street is pretty small town.
there's some bars. I mean, I've been to Columbus,
so you can find bars anywhere in Wisconsin.
Yeah.
And churches. Okay.
Yeah, I've been to a few bars in Columbus, that's about it.
There's Hotel Rogers in Beaver Dam. The historic Hotel Rogers stood in for Tucson's Hotel Congress, the site of the Dillinger gang's capture after a fire broke out and the outlaws were recognized by authorities. So there's a lot of recreation of different locations within the state of Wisconsin.
Hotel Rogers, I've been to.
That's kind of cool. Yeah. All right, Kayla, you're going to perk up for this one. Ishnala Supper Club in Wisconsin Dells.
Ooh, the number one supper club in Wisconsin.
And it did come up in one of our prior episodes.
And they just made a like Visit Wisconsin or Discover Wisconsin commercial, which I think is seen like outside of the state too. And it features Ishnala in the commercial as well.
And for those who are listening and are wondering why all of a sudden Kayla popped up out of nowhere, she did miss the introductions, but she joined a few minutes late and we forgot.
I did. So. And I really wanted to make so many F-boy comments.
Boy. Why didn't you F-boy?
So are we on, is this where the guys were burning the money in the Ishnala?
It is where the guys were, again, from Chicago.
Yeah, right? Those damn fibs again.
Wanton
Melanesians.
Yeah. But anyway, so there was a car chase scene involving Dillinger that was filmed near the Ishnala Supper Club. So might pop up in that movie. We also have the Mirror Lake State Park, Lake Delton. Movie gunshots also rang out at Mirror Lake State Park in Lake Delton. The park hosted several night shoots, and observers heard gunfire and squealing tires as late as midnight. Production keeping people up late, man. I'm telling you.
Lake Delton. I mean, you're just outside the Dells.
Yeah, it's funny how it notes that as late as midnight.
Those wild animals. Production also had nearby private lighting shut down and had the lake declared off limits to the public for optimum seclusion. So,
I hope they weren't shooting in the summer. That would have
not gone so well.
Not appreciate people would be that.
Losing their minds.
Yep. Okay. And then Oshkosh, we have Oshkosh recreated two famous Dillinger robberies for enemies. The American Bank and Trust Company in Racine set at Oshkosh's Masonic Temple, and the Security National Bank and Trust in Sioux Falls at a bank office building at 404 Main Street, which retained the film's prop bank sign as part of a display commemorating the film. So. And then last but not
least, there's a Sioux Falls, Wisconsin.
No, so the location was a bank office building at 404 Main Street, which they used to recreate the Security National Bank and Trust from Sioux Falls. So they used a location in Oshkosh to represent this bank from Indiana.
Gotcha.
I believe. So then last but not least, we have the EAA Aviation Museum, also in Oshkosh. So the 1929 Ford Tri-Motor aircraft featured prominently in the Public Enemies movie depicting the aircraft that the FBI used to transport Dillinger to Chicago from Arizona is part of the EAA Aviation Museum permanent collection. And also the EAA's Pioneer Field was the filming location for the scene in which Johnny Depp gets out of the Midway Airport in Chicago. So they did some filming there as well for the
and movie. Interesting timing, since this week is the EAA fly-in. Yep. As we are recording.
Okay, now I'm talking.
I thought you were joking.
You sound like a dolphin. What is going on there?
I was gonna say EAA Adventures, and I just couldn't get it out. And I've literally one beer.
I was very like conscious of my pronunciation.
Sorry. I just couldn't get it out. My tongue got a little twisted.
Yeah. Oh my goodness. So those are the, that's the information that I had. There's plenty more, I'm sure, if you want to deep dive into any of the specific gangsters, but at a high level, that's kind of some of the fun history.
No information on gangsta Dina B back in the 80s or anything, though.
No, somehow I feel like if you shared Dina anything, I'd have to redact it.
What was my nickname?
Dina B.
Funky Cole Medina.
Yeah. Man, I didn't have a nickname. Still don't have a nickname. I'm just Erica.
I mean, we could make some really good ones up based on what we've heard today if you'd really like one.
I'd be curious what you guys come up with, but I don't know if I would stick with it.
Maybe we'll do that the next time. I'll think about it.
It's, well, kind of a anecdote. My name that I was given was actually selected specifically so that there would be no nicknames.
Same. My mom said they didn't want it to be able to be shortened or lengthened or add a Y.
And I'm just like the complete opposite. I'm like, I wish I would have had a nickname, so I'm going to give my kids names that have nicknames.
I think your gangsta name should be something Rick or Ricky.
could be something little, that doesn't little Ricky. Sound female.
Little Ricky or something.
What's the Ricky? I
don't know. Erica.
Ricky. Gotcha. Sorry, you lost me on that one. Everybody got it, gosh. But me.
So that's everything that I had kind of in relation to the facts, but a lot of that information I also got kind of ties into what I'm using as our Wisco High Note. I really did try to see if they had any, because we have such a rich connection to gangsters, I'm like, surely there must be some kind of festival that we have that pays homage to gangsters, right? But I couldn't find anything. But a lot of the information about the different locations that I talked about came off of Travel Wisconsin's website, because they have two gangster tours, a northern tour and a southern tour, that takes you to various locations that we just talked about with ties to Wisconsin's gangster history.
Where is the southern tour out of?
So we did cover a few of those. A lot of the southern locations are actually more connected to the Public Enemies movie and not so much to actual gangster activity. But it says, this is from their website. Oh, so it says
where things were filmed and whatnot.
Yeah. I mean, gotcha. There's some because of Racine, there was the bank robbery in Racine from John Dillinger. But so the website for Travel Wisconsin says, go on the lam in Wisconsin and experience the rich lore and legend of Wisconsin's history and a little Hollywood magic for yourself. The following itinerary will guide you through some of Wisconsin's most notorious locations. Rats need not apply. So the northern tour is where it takes you to Manitowish Waters, Corduroy, Lac du Flambeau, Minocqua, Hayward, Mercer, Hurley, and Miscuano Island. So my guess is that these tours are not like a day trip. I feel like this is going to be a couple days where you're staying at different locations, because you're talking a couple hours between some of these different locations, and it's got a lot of them. So I feel like it would be really kind of, it's like a trip. You're going to go on vacation to do this,
That sounds like a week long visiting all those places.
Yeah.
I feel like it'd be kind of fun.
I wonder if it's got to be a self-guided, right?
I'd have to look more closely at the site, but I don't think so, because I would think that as part of the tour that you'd be
on a bus or something?
Learning the history about it and things like that. So I'll have to look more into it. But I mean, like, yeah, Minocqua is a fun place to visit. Hayward's a fun place to visit. I mean,
Erica, I can just picture you canceling your Disney World vacation and being like, we're going to do the Northern Gangster Tour in Wisconsin instead.
No.
The kids are old enough.
Nope.
No, no height requirements for these rides.
Just doesn't quite compare to Disney, so I'm, no.
Maybe next time.
Maybe next time. The Southern Tour takes you to Darlington, Columbus, Beaver Dam, Madison, the Wisconsin Dells, Lake Delton, Milwaukee, Racine, Oshkosh, and Lake Geneva. Another one where you're going to a lot of different places and you're covering a fair bit of ground.
Definitely do the northern one. I'm thinking.
I would do the northern.
Been to Darlington and Columbus, and they're not a whole lot there.
I think that's a lot of dieted.
Lots of driving. Yeah, it's gotta be for that.
Well,
long.
And that's why, like, I think you'd probably end up being on like a bus or something. You have like specific places that you stay, or that are probably tied to gangster history. Like some of these places are actually operating as bed and breakfast and stuff like that. So I don't know, for those that are interested, I think it's a pretty interesting thing to maybe do. Maybe
all right, if anybody does it, write in to us and let us know how it is.
Yeah, right.
I think they are self-guided. I'm looking, there's no place to sign up for it.
Huh. That seems odd. But anyway. But that is what I had as the high note, is that you can go to Travel Wisconsin and you can check out the Northern and Southern Tour, whether it's self-guided or something that you sign up for. You can check out different locations within Wisconsin that have connections to gangster history. So if that's your jam.
I had no idea we had so much gangster history in Wisconsin, although most of these guys come from Illinois. So
what good place to hide out.
Those badasses.
Yeah.
Geez, so we're mostly boys. German, Polish, and gangsta up in this state.
Bad Chicago boys.
Well, and it just makes you think, like, how did they act when they were hanging out in these areas? Were they just like
guys on vacation,
blending in so that they wouldn't?
Yeah, they're not
attention?
Wearing their like trench coats and
I mean, the one guy went fishing.
John Gotti collars.
Yeah, probably. Like. I feel like, because I mean, you're talking like Northwoods, Wisconsin.
Yeah.
I mean, you act like a Chicago gangster, that you're going to be looking at you funny. But if you just try to blend in.
They're all wearing Summerfest sweatshirts and like doing, you know, the normal Wisconsin stuff.
They probably just start talking and be like, you're not from around here, are you?
They have Buckingham Badger.
Buckingham
sweatshirts.
Buckingham Ulysses.
That's it. Ulysses. I still remember. See, I couldn't remember.
By one of the way, those facts that Erica taught us.
I'm just taking a bite of my amaretto infused chocolate, and it is amazing.
It sounds amazing.
Oh man. No, it does sound really good. And it's that time of night where I feel like a good chocolate nightcap.
I think any time of day you'd be like, it's a good time for chocolate.
It's true. Yeah. It's true.
Your nickname is gonna be like Chocolate Girl or something.
Like Dirty Chocolate. Wait. Choco. Dirty Chocolate.
Can we just call her Choco?
Choco, Dirty Choco.
Erica Choco Gangsta.
I think you need to work on it.
I'm going to work on it.
What is up with Kayla's face? She doesn't like that nickname?
Not at all.
Well, you were making like a really painful, like weird face.
It just wasn't a catchy gangster name.
No. All right.
Well, I think we might all need to come up with a
baby
gangster
face
name.
Were good ones. If Bugs and Babyface can get along, like...
I don't know if they actually were, you may not have been associated, or they could have been from rival gangs.
Yeah. Well, when I was in Jamaica, there was a dude named Chocolate and he was the DJ.
Oh my gosh. Oh my gosh. The big bamboo.
The big bamboo. We had a really hard time talking to this guy, and literally his name was Chocolate. And we're just like, but your name is Chocolate.
Who is this guy?
One of my favorite stories of all time from when I worked at Harley was there was a trip that I took out to York, Pennsylvania, and I met a guy who's at work who is named Cupcake. And he used to be married to a exotic dancer named Ginger Snap.
Oh my God.
Because he had
kids.
We like bonded. We bonded over tattoos because he saw my tattoos and he was commenting on them. And then, you know, then he was showing off his and like he was a big dude. Like we had to go talk to him and we're like, oh, what's this guy's name? And somebody told us Cupcake. We looked at him and I'm like, you better not be messing with us over that being his name. I don't know why we're walking up to this guy and calling him Cupcake. You mean
wedding cake instead of Cupcake?
Right. No, this guy, he was like a big guy and he like looked intimidating. We're like, if you're wrong, I don't want to be going and calling this guy Cupcake. But anyway, he liked to cook or something. So he earned the nickname from like baking. But it's funny because he commented on my tattoos and then he was showing off his own tattoos. And like one of them was like a cover up job because he used to have Ginger Snap tattooed on his arm. And of course, we're like, well, why the heck did you have Ginger Snap tattooed on your arms? And apparently he used to be married to an exotic dancer named Ginger Snap. So
he should have put a big cupcake over the top of it.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. So I'm just like, yeah. So I just kind of met a guy named Cupcake who used to be married to an exotic dancer named Ginger Snap. Is just like if I could say it, it would be funny, but yeah. But no, that's probably one of my favorite stories of all time. Nicknames are pretty hilarious sometimes. But anyway, for those who are still with us, because we have definitely gotten off topic here at the end.
A little off topic. Just a smidge.
You know, we'll certainly get back on track with some more of our normal fare during the next episode. But we hope you enjoyed our little diversion into some of our gangster history. And until next time, eat, drink, and be wary. Thank you for listening to Beer, Cheese, and Murder. We would like to also thank the references that make this podcast possible. A full list of references can be found on our website at beercheeseandmurderpodcast.com. Be sure to follow us on Instagram at beercheeseandmurderpod, where pictures from today's episode are available for your viewing. If you would like to share your feedback, Wisco facts, case suggestions, stories, or just whatever, please email us at contact@beercheeseandmurderpodcast.com. Don't forget to tell your friends, but most importantly, until next time, eat, drink, and be wary.